want to do is start a three-part little mini-series on Jesus as miracle worker and prophet in the New Testament. And we'll be kind of jumping around, but trying to struggle with this whole issue of what did miracles mean back then? What do they mean today? What role, if any, do they play in our faith? Are they a faith-strengthening kind of thing, or are they a stumbling block to our faith because they're so weird? What are the New Testament writers saying to us about miracles? And then what can we learn from that? And on Saturday, Jane and I are going to be doing a session together talking about some insights from African cultures with which she has worked. Because I think most of all, what's going on in miracles is a struggle of powers. Jesus is the new power, God's power, entering into a world of evil power, of old powers. And especially in the exorcism stories, you see the kinds of power struggles going on. We'll look at a variety of stories that have those. And what she's told me anyway is that in African culture, these kinds of power struggles are the ability to do power, to manifest power, is very important in people's religious life. First of all, I'd love to hear from some of you about what you think about miracles. Why don't I just say a word, though? The word miracle is not biblical. You'll never find the word miracle in the Bible, or you shouldn't. If you do, let me know which translation that's in. The gospel writers didn't have that sort of general category. Instead, they used words like signs. This is probably the most common. The Greek word is semeia, signs. Wonders is more common in the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So, and this word is terata. Or sometimes they use other kinds of words, like, I couldn't think of a noun for this one, but it's the noun that would be related to this word, the verb that says behold. So it'd be like things that cause you to look at them or that point out something. And I think that's like the meaning of signs here, where it points to something. But anyway, whatever word they use for them, there are a tremendous number of stories that we would call miracle stories as the general category of stories. Healings, as well as nature miracles, like the one we're going to look at today, the feeding of the 5,000, where Jesus provides or does something with nature, like the stilling of the storm or walking on the water, those kinds of things. I was just reading yesterday, there are 56 of these miracle stories in the Synoptic Gospels alone. That's not including the Gospel of John. And then John, in addition, has 7 signs that Jesus does, the semeia, in the Gospel of John. So anyway, these are really important in the Gospels, and I think we need to grapple with what role they do play, both in the faith of early Christian people and also in our own faith, as we tend to, I think, in North American Christianity, tend to kind of steer clear of miracles and not exactly know what to do with them. So let's start by hearing from some of you what you do with miracles. What do you think of miracles? Do they strengthen your faith, the miracle stories? Or are they a stumbling block in the sense that they sort of defy nature in some odd ways that make you feel like there's just sort of magic and primitive religion going on? Or how would you know if you've experienced a miracle? What would be the criteria for, is this a miracle?
I attended a meeting at an Episcopal church one evening, and they had the laying on of hands. I had a terrible, terrible lower back ache that it was just excruciating. And people were going forward. Of course, I was very skeptical, and I just sat back, and I wanted to go forward, but I thought, no, I can't, you know, be a part of this. And then finally I thought, okay, if there's anything really to this, Christ, you are in this, then I will accept, I would love to be healed of this horrible pain. And I did go forward and sat in a chair, and this man prayed over me. And I never had that pain again in my life. Hmm. I guess that's a miracle. Mm-hmm. God was telling me something. I can do something for you if you ask for it. But I went as a doubting Thomas.
Now, if you had gone to the doctor and gotten healed, would that have been a miracle?
I'd been to the doctors. They couldn't. Couldn't find out what was wrong with me.
Well, that really sounds like a miracle. Thank you for that. Dan?
It seems to me like we live in a culture that's kind of scientific and really rational. We reason things out. And that maybe an African culture would dabble in the supernatural more. Mm-hmm. And that seems very foreign to a practical Western mind. So I think that's why in the 60s that acid was a popular thing for people, because it put them in a different mindset that dabbled into areas in the mind that I don't think the typical Westerner uses, superstition or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do have this real split between science, or having explained the whole natural world scientifically, and then if something defies nature, then we sort of define it as a miracle, I think. Whereas the ancients, as I understand it anyway, had much more of a view of seeing the supernatural present in every aspect of life in ways. Like we saw in some of those parables a couple weeks ago with the Elder Hostel, that they thought a seed growing was a miracle, because the seed goes in the ground, dies, and then comes to life. It's a resurrection event every time a seed grows. That they saw a lot more involvement of supernatural forces in all the events of life that now we have the ability to explain, and so therefore we don't call them miracles. And so the other thing to say is that there were a lot of miracle workers around in Jesus' time. It wasn't unique at all to do miracles. You see that a little bit in the book of Acts, that there are other traveling magicians or miracle workers who are doing various things. And we certainly know from looking at Greek culture, as well as Jewish culture at that time, that there were people doing healings especially, but you know, working little magic things kind of, and helping people. Asclepius is the most famous of the healers in Greek culture. That's the one that used for the American Medical Association thing, isn't it? The Asclepius' staff with the snake coiled around it. That's the attribute of Asclepius, the Greek healer, and which still continues now into our time. But anyway, so there wasn't anything really unique about being one who heals people. There were other healers in the culture.
That Asclepius wrote before the Gospel of John was written, right?
There was certainly...
Because I read some of Asclepius' stuff, and there's a story in his writing that almost duplicates the healing of the blind man in John, where you put mud on a person's eyes, and then you spit on the ground and make a mud pack. And, I mean, it's just almost verbatim. And there's some speculation that some of the miracle stories were lifted out of those earlier names.
Yeah, I think there's a sense in which Jesus couldn't have been believed to be God's prophet or God's Messiah if he hadn't done healing, because there was certainly an expectation that you would, if God had really sent you, you would have the power to work miracles. And it's interesting to think about what might be some connection there. Yeah, people were expecting miracles, unlike us. It's interesting to see then what the gospel writers do with the miracle stories, because I think they themselves hold them in a sort of tension, and John most of all, of should the miracles be what bring you to faith, but then what's the difference between Asclepius or Jesus or anybody else? So Asclepius heals you and you come to believe in him as God. Well, you know, so should you believe because of miracles, or are the miracles a little bit kind of dangerous or ambiguous, in the sense that if you only believe because of those, then you're not really seeing Jesus as God's Son, God's anointed one, the one who calls you to a new way of life, the one who inaugurates a new kingdom. And we'll look at that in Luke tomorrow and in John today, the way that the different gospel writers incorporate the miracle stories into their narratives and then try to tell you what they think miracles really should mean in the life of faith. What the role of them is, and they use them a little bit differently. One of the theories, and certainly just a hypothesis, I don't know what to think of it, is that in John, the Gospel of John, the author, when he finally compiled this after a couple generations of oral transmission, where the stories were handed down orally, when he sat down to write his narrative, he had available to him a gospel, or an account, you could call it a gospel in quotes, an account that was nothing but miracle stories. It was simply these signs stories, or Semeia. And this is called the Semeia source theory, that John had a whole book of signs available to him, and the people in his community really liked these sign stories. They liked to tell and retell these miracle stories. But that John had some questions about that, about whether signs and miracles really should be the center of your faith as a Christian, or whether it should be something more that calls you to faith. So that what John did was take these signs and put them in his chapters. There's one in chapter 5, one in chapter 6, one in chapter 7. But then add to it a discourse where Jesus talks to the people about what this miracle should mean to them, and tries to bring them along to the point where they don't just believe because of the miracles, but they believe because of who he is as God's son. And we'll see that, especially in John 6 here. Jesus finally says to the crowds, hey, you believe because of the loaves. You believe because I gave you bread. But that's not why you should believe. That's not what faith is about. And so there's this ongoing tension in the Gospel of John about the role of these miracles. They certainly are very powerful events that happen in people's lives. But yet John seems to also be wanting to, in a sense, kind of wean us from a strictly miracle-based faith that just looks for one miracle after another to manifest God's power. So it's an interesting dynamic going on in the Gospel of John, and I think an interesting theory too, that the Gospel writers themselves really, I think, struggled with a little bit.
I think that was one reason the charismatic movement has sort of dwindled, because they put too much emphasis on the healing.
Healing for healing's sake. And yet, I think the reason they were popular is because we, as North American Christians, probably don't put enough emphasis on healing.
No, there was a time for the charismatic movement, and I don't play it down in any way, except that I saw that it was going in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And when it first started, why, it had some very beautiful characteristics about it. And it was truly, I mean, it was a great help to me. But then when I began to see another direction it was going in, it bothered me.
And maybe one of the things we can learn from African churches is how to recover this sense of the healing power of God in our lives as not something that detracts, but that really enhances our faith, and it needs to be a part of the life of the church. We can talk about it anyway. It's hard to know in all these. I don't know, Nancy's a nurse. Do you have anything to add?
I'm hesitant to say that some of the things that I've seen are miracles, because then I ask myself, why didn't I see a miracle in another situation? But there are things that are beyond explaining that could only be the presence of God. And I guess in my own life, there have been times when I've thought, this is beyond explaining humanly. Mm-hmm. And just in the way life events work. And I start to look for miracles then, and the more I look and the more I'm open to it, the more I see. And I've seen in the light of some of my clients, some of my patients, especially those who were terminally ill, close to death, some of them I have witnessed not healing, but the miracle of life at death, the miracle of a radiance being emulated from their presence as they die. And those aren't things you'd tell too many people, mm-hmm. because people kind of think, oh, yeah, we want you to be my nurse. But a sensitivity to that sort of has brought me awakened to just even the miracle of death and life beyond that. Miracles of healing, well, we hear about them, we read about them, and I believe they happen. I think that many drugs are miracles. I think that our words can be a miracle if we are open to that, or if we acknowledge the presence of God in whatever way we can manifest a miracle.
Great, thanks. Well, I'm glad you said that about drugs too, because I think the ancients in Jesus' time, they would have believed that healing was a miracle no matter how it came about, whereas we tend to say it's not a miracle unless you can't explain it. Mm-hmm. So if it's done by a drug, it's not a miracle. Mm-hmm. Or if it's done by a doctor, that's why I asked you about that, it's not a miracle. Whereas, you know, they would have seen that the healing that takes place is a miracle, and however it comes about, wonderful. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, when the vaccine against polio was discovered, it was a miracle. Society acknowledged it, there were great celebrations all over the world. Well, now, we don't think of that as a miracle. People don't sometimes even get their kids immunized because, well, that's not really a miracle. Polio's been wiped out, so big deal. And we have to look back at all of those discoveries and acknowledge they came from somewhere.
Well, these are the kinds of questions I'd invite you to think about in these next couple days, and we'll talk even more about tomorrow when we do look at some healing stories. And on Saturday as well, we'll look at two different healing stories in the Gospel of Luke. But today I wanted us to look at the feeding of the 5,000. Since tonight is our solidarity meal, on Thursdays we try to think about food issues in our world. And that's why we had the simple supper on Thursday nights. And I think Jesus was one who was also very concerned about food issues, about the fact that he looked around and saw so many hungry people in his world, the starving multitudes, and tried to help them. And the story of the feeding of the 5,000 is the one single miracle story, if we, again, to use that word in quotes, miracle, since that's not a biblical word, but it's the one single manifestation of his power that we find in all four of the Gospels. The Synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, have a lot of the similar stories to each other, and then John has another bunch of signs. But this is the only one that is common to all four Gospels. And indeed, you actually kind of find it six times, because Matthew and Mark have it as a doublet, or have it twice. Little variation on the theme. Matthew and Mark also have a story just a couple chapters later that's called the Feeding of the 4,000, that in, for all practical purposes, is almost an identical kind of story. So it's a story that we find six times in the Gospel. It's obviously a story that is really, really important in the life of the early church and in the minds of the Gospel writers. They wrote it down a lot, and they saw this as kind of a central story in Jesus' ministry. So I think it's a good one for us to look at on our solidarity day as we think about food issues in our world and in our community. I'll just lay out some form critics, one kind of gospel critics here, gospel interpreters, remind us that these stories, before they were written down, were passed on orally for a couple generations. And that doesn't mean that they got disordered. I think we find in Africa or other places that oral storytellers are very accurate. You can remember oral stories really well as you pass them down, and it's a mode of transmission that we have lost in our culture. We can't even memorize a little poem. A lot of times we don't teach our kids to memorize, but they certainly had a great lively and rich trove of stories that were transmitted orally. But stories that are transmitted orally tend to follow set patterns so that you can keep them straight. And oftentimes miracle stories follow a set pattern with some variation. I mean, every miracle story is different twists, but the basic pattern often tends to be first a statement of the setting. It was evening, Jesus was in Galilee, or that kind of thing. Or it was in the early morning, he was sitting in his house, or something like that. I mean, he'll tell you where. Then, I mean, this is kind of obvious for any sort of story. Then we're told the cast of characters. Jesus was there, and the Pharisees were watching him. Or Peter's mother-in-law was there, and Jesus. Or that kind of, where the personalities are laid out. Then there's a statement of the need or the problem. It could be, and a woman came to him who had a bad knee. Or a woman came to him who had a terrible backache for many years and could find no healing from the doctors. Or the people were starving, there was nothing to eat. You know, that kind of, there'd be a statement of the problem. Then comes the resolution of the problem. Jesus does something, or something happens that is the miracle. But it's the miracle itself is often not narrated in any kind of specific details. There are those times where he says he took mud, he put it on the guy's eyes, and suddenly could see. But oftentimes we're not told exactly what happened to bring about the miracle. I mean, how it actually happened. The details or the mechanics of it are left undescribed oftentimes. But then you see how the problem is resolved, and there is oftentimes a proof of the fact that it has been resolved. Like Peter's mother-in-law, she got up and served them. I think that's a really funny one. The way you know that Peter's mother-in-law has been healed is immediately she waits on the men that were there. or the proof of Jesus' resurrection is that he ate fish. I mean, he's passed through these walls and stuff, and then he eats fish. Or there's a lot of times eating is proof that someone is now well or that they are now alive. The little girl that was dead sits up and proves that she is indeed alive. Or oftentimes there will be a proof. Something happens to prove to the people and to you that indeed this has happened. Then oftentimes there's a statement of faith or an acclamation where the people say, "Now I believe that you are the Son of God." Or, "Now I truly have seen that you are the Lord of life." Sometimes not. I mean, any one of these can be missing. And sometimes they're all missing. Or not all of them, but sometimes there'll just be a setting, a statement of need, a resolution, and that's it. Nobody comes to faith through it. It's very interesting to see the variety. Or sometimes there's a whole dimension of conflict that's added in. Like Jesus will be about to heal, and then the Pharisees will say it's not lawful to heal on the Sabbath, and then there will be a whole little controversy introduced in there as well. But anyway, oftentimes it's helpful to know the basic pattern of your miracle form, and then you can see how the specific stories fit, so we can look at that too. Just a helpful thing, and this we'll look at tomorrow also as we look at the healing stories. Okay, with all that introduction now, let us look at John chapter 6. Now, I picked this one because I think in a sense, John's account of the feeding of the 5,000 is the most political. We sometimes think that John sort of spiritualizes everything. In this case, he leaves in some important political dimensions of this whole story. And then I also think it's interesting to see what John does with the story, what Old Testament connections he's trying to build, and then also what he does with the whole discourse that follows about bread and what he's trying to tell us about Jesus and bread. The whole of John 6 is about bread, 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 where it finally culminating in him saying, "I am the bread of life. Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you. I am the bread of life that came down from heaven." So anyway, but this is the miracle that sets the stage for that whole discourse about bread. Let's read it. Does somebody want to read verses 1 through 15 slowly, loudly, clearly?
"Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is, the Sea of Tiberias. And a great crowd of people followed him, because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover feast was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, 'Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?' He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 8 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite.' Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, 'Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?' Jesus said, 'Have the people sit down.' There was plenty of grass in that place, and the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, 'Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted.' So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself.
Great, thanks. Okay, what kinds of things do you notice here? What strikes you in this story?
I fairly closely followed the format that you laid out, starting with the setting and the characters.
Sea of Galilee and Tiberias. Then, now interesting, look at verse 2 there. That's kind of an interesting one that would be a sign of this sign source. If you're going to believe in this sign source theory, that John has this document from this community that loved miracles, okay, that loved to tell miracle stories, this would be that. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs he was doing for the sick, that these are people who follow him because of his miracle working at this point. And John is going to try to lead us away from that view of faith to a, if you want to call it, a deeper view of faith that doesn't just rest on signs, on one sign after another. But anyway, okay, so there's the setting. Then the cast of the character. Jesus went up on the mountain, sat down with his disciples. And then another word about the setting, which John often gives us. He always sets things in the Jewish liturgical year. If it's not Passover, it's the Feast of Booths. There's one festival always going on, and he'll tell us which Jewish festival it is. So here it's Passover. Okay, so all that is the setting. Then the problem, this big crowd is coming in with nothing to eat. Then there is another whole dimension in here, though, that this one that I didn't put on. And this is all these questions with Philip, right? Right in here. You see the need. You've got all these people. They have nothing to eat. But then there's the questions. Where are we going to get bread? How are we going to feed these people? And then there's also the element of doubt introduced in here, right? Where Philip says, well, I'll tell you. It's interesting. You had 8 months' wages or 8 days' wages. We had 6 in ours, I think. But anyway, there's the, or we could call it, let's see, some kind of obstacle, we'll say, is introduced too in this narrative at this point. And then Jesus overcomes that obstacle and effects the miracle. Uh-huh. So it does often follow this form, although with tremendous variation, of course.
Another word question is in that black one. It's have the people sit down, and in this one it's make the people sit down.
Uh-huh.
And those are a lot of different words.
Don't you think they have the same sense? They'll kind of cause the people to sit. I know what the Greek word is, seat the people, basically. I think. Let's just see here. I'm sure I won't be able to find it, but 6:10. Yeah, there are some other differences, too. Now, one of the interesting points of this story is that you guys in the Black Bibles have men throughout, and indeed, that is the Greek word that's being used here. It's not the anthropoi, or the word that you would translate as people. It's androi. It seems that it's just men here. And some of the synoptics say there were 5,000 men, to say nothing about the women and children who were also there. But in this situation, it seems that there were just men for some reason, or at least that's how John writes it, almost as, and then there's militaristic language here too, like the companies, don't they have them sit down in groups of tens and stuff here? Mm-hmm. Oh no, I guess not. I'm getting them mixed up, but anyway, all right, let's see, have the people sit down, 6:10. Make them to sit down, okay. Or cause them to, no, make them to sit down is more what it would be. Uh-huh.
Another thing that strikes me is there isn't any, like, teaching. It seems to me in the other feeding of the 5,000, like, all the people are there, and Jesus teaches them for a while, and then they're all tired and hungry, and then they have to sit around, then they have to wonder, how are they going to feed them? But here, the minute that Jesus sees them coming,
he knows they're hungry.
A large crowd coming, Jesus right away thought about bread. Why didn't he think about teaching them anything first?
Yeah, no, that is really... The teaching comes afterwards in this whole discourse. But yeah, that might be an indication of this sign source that has just one miracle sort of after another. Yeah, whereas in the synoptics, they had a day of sermons preached at them, and that's why they're hungry. That's interesting.
Could it have something to do with being Passover?
Well, what, yeah, let's talk about that. What does the Passover setting do then? That John tells us now the Passover was at hand. What images or what would that elicit in your mind?
Well, there's a special celebration of Passover, and of course, I associate it with the types of food that are served at that time.
Uh-huh. And what are those types of food?
Unsalted, uh-huh. Non-yeast.
Yeah, the non-leavened bread is really, really important in the whole Passover liturgy, right? You eat bread at least four times there, and that would certainly, the bread, the wine, and then you also eat lamb, but bread would be a really important aspect of the Passover liturgy.
So maybe this is the celebration of Passover that was being done first in remembrance of Passover before he began his teaching.
Others? What kinds of
things? It says the Jewish Passover feast was near. It doesn't say it was right at that time.
Yeah, I don't know if this would be the actual Passover meal, but certainly John wants us to have Passover in our mind. I mean, he wouldn't have had to say that at all. You know, so what if it was near? But he likes to bring in those Jewish festivals that are near or at hand, and all the miracles happen around a Jewish festival. This is the second Passover in John. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there's only one Passover that happens, and it happens when Jesus gets to Jerusalem at the end to be killed. But in John, there are three Passovers.
Whereas this one, it says, now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand.
Yeah. Or near. Uh-huh. In Goose, I think is what it is. Let's see. Okay, so but let's take a minute here and think of some other Old Testament images that came to mind. Because I think we tend to think that Jesus is unique, and or that Jesus is wonderful and the Messiah because he's unique and different. Things. He was the first and last person to ever be God's real son like that. Whereas the gospel writers or the early Christians had the idea that Jesus was unique and wonderful because he stood in the tradition of Moses and the prophets. And they liked to connect Jesus back into the Old Testament and show how Jesus was like Moses, was like Elijah, was like the great prophets that God had raised up through time immortal. And I think there's a lot of that going on in this story as well. So a guest asked me last week, I have no idea, this was just sort of out of the blue, we were at coffee break, and she said, now Barbara, is it true that everything in the New Testament is already in the Old Testament? And, you know, I said, well, yes and no. I mean, I think that yes and no. I mean, Jesus, we do come to see finally how Jesus is unique. On the other hand, I don't think he's as unique as we Christians who are so ignorant of the Old Testament often want to believe. Many of the stories and deeds that Jesus does are already found in the Old Testament. And the gospel writers wanted us to know that. They wanted Jesus to be seen in continuity with the Old Testament prophets and stories. So what are some, as you look at this story, what are some other Old Testament events that come to mind where this similar kind of event, or maybe not similar, but some of the same sort of aspects were present? We've talked about Passover now, the idea of bread and the Passover, so that would connect us to the Exodus there. Any other connections to that?
Manna from heaven.
Yeah, manna. That's probably the most important. Indeed, that's what Jesus is going to pick up on later in the discourse about bread, is contrasting his manna with Moses' manna. But certainly that story of how Jesus, or how God provided food for the people in the wilderness is really important. In fact, let's look at one of those, because I think that also is similar to Philip's question here, to Jesus' question here. Let's look at Numbers 11 for a minute. And whoever finds the page number in one of those black Bibles, why don't you call it out to us here? 124, page 124 in the black Bibles. Why don't we read Numbers 11, verses 4 through, I'll read it because I'm going to skip around. I see that we don't have a lot of time. But anyway. Okay, as you know, the people got led out from the Exodus with the Passover event and, you know, the unleavened bread there. And then they're in the wilderness, and then they start having second thoughts a lot because they're hungry. You know, here they are in the wilderness. They don't have enough to eat, and this is just classic. verse 4, the rabble among them had a strong craving, and the Israelites also wept again and said, if only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we used to eat in Egypt for nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our strength is dried up, and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at. So a lot of grumbling about various things. And then skip to verse 10, where Moses starts complaining to God. Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families at all the entrances of the tents. Then the Lord became very angry, and Moses was displeased. Moses said to the Lord, why have you treated your servant so badly? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people on me? Did I conceive this people? It's interesting. Here he uses now feminine images in these next two verses. Did I conceive all this people? Did I give birth to them that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a sucking child to a land that you promised to their ancestors? And then here's his question. Where am I to get meat to give to all this people? For they come weeping to me and say, give us meat to eat. I am not able to carry these people alone. This then leads into the whole story of Eldad and Medad and how the spirit that was on Moses became more dispersed among the people. But anyway, this question, where am I to get meat to give to all this people? Isn't this the same question that Jesus asks, at least kind of, where Jesus says, where are we to buy bread for these people to eat? In John 6, right? It's the same kind of question. So Jesus, now, John carefully tells us in parenthesis here in John 6, he said this to test Philip, for he himself knew where he would get bread to eat. It's sort of like, now don't think for a minute that Jesus didn't know where he was going to get this bread. But John has Jesus say a question that is very similar to Moses' question here in the wilderness. And I think the people in the early church knew all the story and would have seen the similarities between these questions. So Jesus is already being situated kind of in the tradition of being in the wilderness and having to provide food for the hungry Israelites who came out of the Exodus. Okay, so there's the manna connection too, the Passover connection, the manna connection. There's also a strong Elijah or Elisha connection going on here. Let's look at 2 Kings chapter 4. And then whoever finds the page number, tell us where it is. 321. Okay. Elijah and Elisha were the two Old Testament prophets whose miracles we read all about, and many kinds of miracles. We'll look at them again tomorrow with the healing miracles, because they also did healings like Jesus then did. But you can imagine, I mean, the early church is trying to establish credibility for Jesus here, and there was strong memory of Elijah especially, who was going to come back in his chariot as he had left. And Elisha also, these were great, great prophets. So if you could link Jesus to them, that would enhance his stature as a great, great prophet in the line of Moses and the others. Okay, so this story I think is very striking for how similar it is here to the feeding of the 5,000. 2 Kings 4, 42 to 44. Does somebody want to read this? Don't worry about the place name. Pronounce it however you want.
A man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing food from the first fruits to the man of God, 20 loaves of barley and fresh ears of grain in his sack. Elisha said, give it to the people and let them eat. But his servant said, how can I set this before 100 people? So he repeated, give it to the people and let them eat. For thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left. He set it before them, they ate, and had some left, according to the word of the Lord.
I had never known about the story until last year when I was working on this feeding of 5,000. I think it's really striking, the similarity here. What are some of the similarities that you see?
Some kind of grain, it's barley.
Yeah, barley and barley, right? We don't eat a lot of barley, but they did. There's barley loaves in John, and there's barley loaves in 2 Kings here.
They had some left?
Yeah, this is really important that they all had they ate to their fill, and had some left over, the sense of abundance that we find in the miraculous abundance that there was, that God provides even enough to have some left over. What else?
My Bible states here that barley was cheap bread, the food of the poor.
Yeah, it is the food of the poor. Uh-huh.
It's interesting to note that the food came from elsewhere, the same as in the story of the 5,000. The boy provided the fish and the loaves in the 5,000. And the man from this other place brought the food.
And there's that the element of doubt, right, or the obstacle. The servant here in 2 Kings says, how can I set this before 100 people? And that's the same thing as Philip says in John 6, kind of, right? A variation. Philip is saying, but 6 days' wages wouldn't be enough to buy food for all these people. So there's someone who doubts in the story, right, in both of the instances. And then the prophet of God, in this case Elisha in the New Testament, Jesus says, no, give it to them. And so they do, and they all ate and they had some left over, according to the word of the Lord. So John's hearers would know this story as well. They would see all these threads from the Passover, through the manna in the wilderness, through this miraculous story here of Elisha telling them to have confidence. There is enough food here in this story. And all this is playing into the story of Jesus. Now, another one that some people propose that I don't know what to think about. It's not as obvious to me, but they say that the rabbis really picked up on this as being a story of God's banquet and the idea of the abundance of food that God provides in the end time for people is in the book of Ruth. So let's look at that and see what you think of that. Now I can't even find Ruth. Joshua Judges Ruth. Here we go. And here the barley would again be the connection. It's barley that is the main grain in the book of Ruth. Somebody say the page number when you find it. It's such a little book.
Ruth what?
Ruth 2 we'll look at first.
What page? 231.
231. Okay. First we had 321, now we have 231. Great. Okay, you know the story of the book of Ruth. She is from Moab. She's not an Israelite, but Naomi, her mother-in-law, has gone to Moab with her husband, and then the husbands die. Ruth married one of Naomi's sons. And so Ruth comes back to Israel now with Naomi, destitute, and poor, and so she gleans in the fields after the reapers. They have that permission in Israel to glean, and Boaz is sort of becomes her benefactor who looks after her to make sure that she gets enough. And in Ruth 2, starting with verse 14, at mealtime Boaz said to her, come here and eat some of this bread and dip your morsel in the sour wine. So Boaz invites Ruth to eat with them. So she sat beside the reapers, and he heaped up for her some parched grain. She ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. And that's the same verb there as we saw in the 2 Kings story, this sort of wonderful idea that you eat until you're full and even have some left over. And then also, again in chapter 3, there's barley going on here as Boaz... in verse 15, Boaz says to her, bring the cloak you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her back. Then she went into the city. And barley plays a big role throughout the story here. So maybe there's a connection there with the barley grain, but certainly there's a connection with the eating till you're full and having some left over. So that's kind of nice. There's women and men that experience this abundance of God's love here.
Could this be a symbolic meaning because the word bread is used so often, even in our Lord's Prayer, you know, give us our daily bread. Could this symbolism be here that God provides so much that we never have to worry? There's always some leftover. There's always some to give to others. And not specifically the bread that we eat, but the spiritual bread. God has so much for us. And that's why the word bread is used so often.
Uh-huh.
Because there's so much symbolism in the Bible that if we don't recognize the symbolism, I think we'll miss a lot of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I really agree with that. Martin Luther says that in, you know, in his catechism, he's got bread, meaning food, clothing, family, shelter, everything I need from day to day, he has be bread in the Lord's Prayer. So yeah, bread is a very loaded term in the Bible. It's everything we need. It's in the Gospel of John, it has all of these meanings to it. It becomes the spiritual food that Jesus gives. But it starts, you know, right at the level of bread. Hungry people who he sees coming to him who have nothing to eat, and he gives them bread. Now, for you, does it, the sort of less it becomes physical bread and the more it becomes spiritual, does that take on more meaning, or it sounds like it?
Yes, much more.
Why more than food in a hungry world?
Because this is what I hunger for.
Uh-huh. We Americans, we have enough to eat, okay?
And then you also said, this is my body broken for you. Uh-huh. Christ himself is out there.
Uh-huh. I think it gets to this whole question, right? Let's go back to John now that we've looked at the these other narratives here and talk about that for a minute. Because certainly you just made that connection with Holy Communion there. This is my body given for you. I think that's also going on in the story of the feeding of the 5,000 here, that the early Christians who told this story and wrote it down wrote it with overtones of the communion liturgy or the Eucharistic liturgy. In verse 11, then Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them. Now, what does that sound like? Those are the words of institution, right? Basically, I mean, that reminds us already, this giving thanks. It's the verb Eucharisto. I mean, we call our Sunday service the Eucharist, which is based on this. This is the Greek word, just like this. I mean, it's the very same. It's the verb, I give thanks. Or I'll do the infinitive here, to give thanks. Eucharistein. So that is the word that's used right here. Well, you can't help but have, you know, shades of Eucharist going through your mind when you hear Jesus, Eucharist sows. Now, it doesn't say, interesting, that he broke the bread. So that's not in there. I mean, if they wanted to just exactly follow the Eucharist, it would have been said he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and distributed. But it has the giving thanks and then the distributing, and I think it does remind us very much of Holy Communion. So what does that do then for you? I mean, what images does that elicit?
I am the bread of life. It's our life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he says that later in the Gospel of John. This is the first I am here. I am the bread of life that he's going to say. Or do you think it says to us also, can you ever go the other direction? You say that it becomes more meaningful as it becomes more spiritual, because that's what I most deeply hunger for. But how about the other direction, that it reminds us that each time we celebrate the Eucharist, there's the reminiscences of feeding the hungry world, of feeding people who are actually starving and hungering for bread. Does that make our Eucharist more meaningful too?
That comes out of the spiritual.
Comes out of the spiritual.
The desire to share. But first, I think you have to be filled with the spiritual in order to feel this sharing with others in the right way. I mean, not to just be giving so that somebody's going to see what you're doing and that you're going to get commended for it. You do it because it's so much a part of yourself that you have no choice.
Others of you? Do you ever think of the feeding of the 5,000 when you go up for communion? Is that an image that ever comes to mind? Or, I mean, I think it was for these people who wrote it down this way that they... Another place that comes out is in verse 12. When they were satisfied, he told the disciples, gather up the fragments so that nothing may be lost. That is the exact sentence, pretty much, that is found in the Didache, is the name of it, which is a first century or early second century liturgy that tells about the church's earliest celebrations of communion. And there's this very same idea of gathering up the fragments, gathering up the klamata is the word for it. I think we've got a little bit of that used in the Marty Haugen Eucharist that we sometimes use, where he's got in the offertory as the grains of wheat, once scattered on the hill, were gathered into one to become our bread. It's the same verb there, the gathering. So that's, again, a Eucharistic euphemism here. The gathering of the fragments would be a reminder of the Eucharist.
I think that suggests to our world today that food or bread is very essential to our physical well-being and very precious, and that we should treat it that way, not be wasteful.
Yeah, I think all these dimensions are going on in this story. I mean, I don't want to play off the spiritual against the physical or whatever, because in John 6, it's clear that they're all present. Jesus then moves from this story into a big discourse about bread. And there is that line where, let me see if I can find it, where he does say, I'm mad at you because you just follow me because of the loaves. I mean, he doesn't, where is it though? Well, in verse 30, they seem to want more and more miracles. He says to them, what sign, or they say to him, what sign are you going to give us so that we may see it and believe you? I mean, they seem to want more and more signs. But here it is. In verse 26, Jesus answered them, very truly I tell you, you are looking for me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures. So he's trying to kind of wean the people from this need for one more miracle after another, and that they don't just follow him because he's the bread man, you know, the bread giver. On the other hand, I think we Christians who are pretty much full all the time and take our food very much for granted tend to think that the true depth of Jesus is found not in sharing food with the hungry, but in a spiritual that somehow leaves the physical realm behind. And I think the placement of the story of the feeding as the thing that leads us into this whole discourse about being the bread of life is an important sort of down-to-earth reminder that pulls us back to remembering, you know, certainly Jesus said, I am the bread of life, I am the food that doesn't perish, seek me, and not just being filled up with all these loaves. But he only did that after having fed the people who are hungry in this miraculous way, that he did want to satisfy the hunger of the world too. So there's both things going on in John 6. There's everything. And finally, the culmination is definitely Eucharistic, where he says to them in verses 53 and following, very truly I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Those who eat my flesh and drink my blood have eternal life, and I will raise them up at the last day. I mean, this is certainly communion, right? Eating flesh, drinking blood. For my flesh is food indeed, my blood is drink indeed. So it certainly culminates. You know, if there's Eucharistic stuff going on here in the feeding of the 5,000, then there's a discourse about bread, and then finally it culminates in the whole proclamation about eating my flesh, drinking my blood, that definitely would remind you of communion. And then, interestingly, it culminates also in people falling away, that this is why people take offense at him. The disciples say the teaching is difficult. Who can accept it? And they take offense at him. And then there's a line that comes right out of our liturgy, or is used in our liturgy. Jesus says to the 12 here in verse 67, do you also wish to go away? Because many people have now left him after this whole incident where he says, I am the bread of life. He says, do you also wish to go away? Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. You know, and so they decide to follow him, but there are many who are offended. So anyway, John 6 is a really important chapter that holds together all these threads. Go ahead.
I'm a little curious. Just, do you have any comment on why the fish get left behind?
Yeah.
I mean, the fish are also multiplied, and then they're not referred to again, and they're not really brought up
I don't know what to think about that, and we don't use fish in communion either, but fish are important in a number of gospel stories, and we just have not picked up on that as in our liturgical celebration. Yeah, the fish get left behind, exactly. And we put wine in instead or something. It's very curious.
The early Christians used it, though, didn't they?
fish. Mm-hmm. Well, as a symbol, but I don't think they ate fish in their Eucharist or anything. But yeah, they had the fish as a symbol. Well, we need to go to our next feeding here at Holden Village. Coffee break. I would just invite you, thinking in our solidarity theme, to think of how this story can enrich our celebration of the Eucharist and our life as God's people. That whatever the miracle was that was going on here, you know, sometimes they say, oh, well, maybe Jesus didn't really multiply things, but everybody had food, you know, hidden in their shirt, but they were afraid to bring it out. You heard that one, his sermon on that one, but they were afraid to bring it out because they knew they'd have to share with their neighbors. I can certainly relate to that here at Holden. You know, we sometimes get into a food hoarding mentality. Maybe you have some snacks up at your house, but you don't want to share with everybody because you don't have a lot of them. Or, you know, you see the plate full of food that's supposed to have enough for 8 people, and you wonder, now, how are these cookies going to be enough to feed this whole table? I better take 4 before it gets running. So, even, you know, if that was a miracle, still, I mean, isn't that an incredible miracle that somehow Jesus was able, with his vision of God's realm, of abundance, that there will be enough food for all and some left over, that Jesus was able to convert hoarders into people who shared and who wanted to participate in his abundant life that he's giving for the whole world. I mean, whatever the miracle is, that's clearly what's going on here, is that Jesus had faith that there was enough, and faith that everyone could be fed, and invited the disciples also to participate in that food sharing, that distribution, and thanksgiving, and that there was even enough to gather up after everyone had been satisfied. I think that's God's vision for our world today also, and we especially remember that on Solidarity Day.